and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With 27 countries and NATO now having expelled more than 140 Russian spies under diplomatic cover, we'll begin with the growing support for the UK Prime Minister Theresa May's response to a Russian nerve agent attack on British soil. Charles Kupchan, a professor of international affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, who spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as special assistant to President Obama for national security, joins us to discuss the unexpectedly strong response in support of the UK's weak leader and whether finally standing up to Putin will curb the Russian president's brazen flouting of international norms. We'll assess why Trump, who has so far not said a bad word about Putin, agreed to expel 60 Russians, and speculate about what possible motives Putin might have for using a weapon of mass destruction against a NATO country. And because so many Russian oligarchs have parked their ill-gotten gains in what is jokingly referred to as Londongrad, is Putin betting that the UK will not freeze these assets because the hit on top of the chaos from Brexit would be too damaging to Britain's banking system? Then we'll examine moves by China's self-declared leader for life, Xi Jinping, to impose Communist Party censorship on Hollywood movies, and speak with Anne Kokas, a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, who is currently a fellow at the Wilson Center working on a project, Border Control on the Digital Frontier, China, the United States, and the Global Battle for Data Security. The author of Hollywood Made in China, she joins us to discuss how, in order to maintain its quota in China's market, which accounts for 1/5 of the global box office, Hollywood is already tailoring its movies to please Communist Party censors. Then finally, we'll discuss the op-ed by former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, Repeal the Second Amendment, and speak with Jonathan Lowy, the director of the Legal Action Project at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He joins us to argue that under current law, most of what the young activists called for at last Saturday's March for Our Lives rallies across the country and around the world would be constitutional. But with another Second Amendment extremist like Justice Gorsuch on the court, even more pro-gun rights pushed by the NRA could become the law of the land. And joining us now is Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and he spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security Affairs. He's the author of The End of the American Era, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Geopolitics of the 21st Century, Power in Transition, The Peaceful Change of International Order, and How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Kupchan.
Glad to be with you.
And NATO announced today it's expelling 7 Russian diplomats who are, I assume, are spies operating under diplomatic cover because of the nerve agent attack on the UK. This is in addition to the fact that 26 countries have also expelled Russian envoys in the last couple of days in solidarity with Theresa May. She's not been seen as a particularly decisive leader, and she has obviously trouble at home in terms of her tenure. But it does seem that a lot of countries have rallied around her and given her a shot in the arm.
Well, it's interesting that we do seem to see a crystallization of a readiness to stand up to Putin in a way that we really have not seen since the invasion of Ukraine back in 2014, when the U.S. and its European allies came together and imposed sanctions with other countries joining in as well. And then we went through a period that involved the Russian intervention in Syria, the Russian hacking into our election. They've been doing the same thing across Europe for the last few years, with no real response. And then you had this poisoning in the UK of a former Russian spy, and all of a sudden that seemed to stiffen the spine of European leaders as well as Donald Trump. And really, since the first time that he became president, he has allowed something to happen that I would call punishment, that I would call pushback against Putin. And so in some ways, this poisoning incident has put people over the top. They are finally ready to to start punishing Putin for his behavior.
Well, we had the shootdown of the Malaysian airliner, which was pretty horrific. And, of course, you mentioned annexing Crimea and starting a war against Ukraine. What's your sense of whether this is going to impact the World Cup? Because there's obviously already Iceland has decided not to go to the World Cup. It seems that that's the kind of thing that would punish Putin more than anything else, because he's acting like a thug and he seems to be pretty immune to criticism. And we can get into speculating why he did it in the first place or why he authorized it. But what's your sense of whether there could be a building movement to boycott the World Cup, Soccer World Cup in the summer in Moscow?
When the Russians first went into Ukraine, there were some folks around who were saying, why don't we boycott the World Cup? Why don't we announce that we're taking it away from Russia? I haven't heard that kind of talk come back. You may recall that when the Brits announced their expulsions, they also announced that the royal family would boycott the cup and would not go to Russia to watch the English team. But I haven't picked up any further discussion about that. If we see Putin retaliate and we get into a tit-for-tat dynamic in which both sides are expelling diplomats, both sides perhaps moving toward economic boycotts or sanctions, then I could see that outcome, because it would definitely hit at Putin and the Kremlin that prizes Russia's place among the nations, and so it would certainly be a serious punishment to Putin. I have yet to pick up that that is now part of the conversation.
Well, there's already been reciprocal expulsion of British diplomats or spies from Russia following Theresa May's expulsion of Russians. But one of the theories that I've heard to sort of explain such a brazen act of using a weapon of mass destruction on a NATO member's soil is a sense that the Russian oligarchs already own London and the Brits are sort of supplicants. What do you make of that?
You know, I think that Putin has gotten away with too much. And he plays a sly game. Going back to the invasion of Ukraine, it's smoke and mirrors. There are little green men. The people that are fighting in Donbas and eastern Ukraine may be Russian soldiers, but they're on vacation. We heard a couple of months ago that a bunch of Russians died in an air strike in Syria, and it turns out they, too, were mercenaries. And then when it comes to hacking, Putin keeps denying that he had anything to do, that Russia had anything to do with the U.S. election. And so it's this constant bobbing and weaving, constant obfuscation of what's going on. But it now appears that that folks have just gotten tired of it. They've run out of patience. And I think that the situation is positive in the sense that countries are standing by the UK, especially the EU, at a time when the UK is actually leaving the European Union. Why London? I think it was more a target of opportunity. You do have former spies that have taken place, taken up residence in the UK. But you're right to point out that there is an enormous amount of Russian money in London, and we have yet to see May take steps to freeze those assets or to do things to go after Putin's inner circle. That may be coming, but I think May is reluctant to do that because of the hit that the British economy would take.
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and he spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security. And his latest book is How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of a Stable Peace. Well, first of all, I wanted to speculate with you about what possible motives. Obviously, there are two audiences, or perhaps three. On the one hand, when Putin apparently authorized the use of polonium against a exiled Russian in London a while back, that was a signal to defectors within the intelligence community that this is your fate. But it was also, I think, a signal to his own audience in Russia that I'm a strong guy and I'm standing up to the West. And a lot of speculation is that this attack on the UK happened just before the Russian election, and that was meant to send a signal to the Russian people that I'm strong and I'm standing up to the West. So what explains, I mean, it seems like he basically gets away with it because, you know, it's a wink and a nod, you know. He denies that he did it to the West while winking to his own people. Like, yes, I did it, and I got away with it, and aren't I clever?
Well, I think you put your finger on both of the motivations. One is that he wants to deter other Russian intelligence agents from turning, and he wants to send the message that if you betray Mother Russia, we will find you and we will make you pay. The other is that Putin has no real political calling card other than nationalism, standing up to the West, pretending that he has taken Russia back to being a great power after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Russia has no knowledge economy. It's still heavily dependent on energy revenues. It's in demographic decline. And so Putin really has nothing there except this brash and aggressive brand of nationalism. Did he authorize this attack to take place just before the Russian election? I think the Russians are good, but they're not that good. I doubt that this was done as an election ploy. But there's no question that Putin, if you look at the election results, you look at the poll numbers over the last few years, he has thrived by peddling and pandering to the Russians, this kind of a brand of nationalism. And the Russians believe the garbage that the Russian media put out. One day after another, you see lies and more lies. The Russians have denied they have had anything to do with this attack. That's hard to believe, given that the agent in question, Novichok, was produced only in Russia, and as far as we know, no one else has access to it.
Well, there's an interesting theory which I wanted to run by you, Charles Kupchan, and that is that my understanding is that the Russian people think that their leader is incredibly clever and that he's pulled off one of the greatest coups of all, which is to basically put his guy in the Oval Office, Donald Trump. And that has led the Russian people to feel somewhat relaxed about the United States, that the Americans aren't going to attack us because our brilliant leader owns the guy in the White House. And that is an explanation for why they chose to beat up on the Brits as a convenient kind of foreign enemy as opposed to the United States, because it wouldn't have worked because the Russian people, I'm told, don't really. Maybe they do now that Trump has finally done something, but prior to that, prior to Trump's expulsion of 60 Russian spies from the U.S., that has been apparently a pretty common mindset, that they figure that Putin is a genius who pulled off the greatest coup of all, which is to put his guy in the Oval Office.
Well, you know, I think that if Putin thought that he had his guy in the Oval Office, he's probably come to a different conclusion, in that the relationship between Washington and Moscow has really deteriorated. And one of the reasons that Congress passed legislation making it difficult for Trump to take sanctions off is because they didn't trust Trump. And they said that they wanted to keep Russia's feet to the fire. And if you, Mr. President, aren't going to do it, we're not going to do it either. And now you have a situation where Trump himself has finally agreed to take steps to punish the Russians. Do they think that they have a guy in the Oval Office, that the Russians are now the puppet masters? I'm not so sure about that, but I do think that they are reveling in the political mess that Donald Trump has made. There's no question that the Russians wanted to sow dissension and polarization in the United States. Most of that was homegrown, but they certainly added to it. And so I think the main their main view right now is that the United States is having a hard time making it through the day because its political institutions and its governance is so messed up.
Well, if Putin's motive was to weaken and divide America, then he has succeeded.
He has succeeded. I mean, I don't want to overstate that success because, you know, 85% of the situation in this country is internal. It has to do with the long-term hollowing out of the political center, the loss of moderates among both Democrats and Republicans. If we were not divided among ourselves, Putin would have a much harder time playing his game. But we give him a lot of grist for the mill, and the Russians have done a very good job of taking advantage of it. We now know that they've been all over Facebook, all over Twitter, buying ads and playing hardball when it came to disrupting our election and trying to orchestrate a Trump victory.
Well, just in the last few minutes, let me try to speculate on Putin's motives here, given, again, what a brazen act it was. One of the other explanations that I've heard is that he got rid of all of his sober, international, experienced people like Sergei Ivanov, his chief of staff, and has brought in a bunch of hawks and sycophants and hardliners. And the worst of all is Nikolai Patrushev, the national security advisor. And there's an ironic situation now where we here in the United States with John Bolton may well have a mirror image of Nikolai Patrushev as our national security advisor in John Bolton, which is certainly doesn't augur well. But I guess the bottom line, what I'm hearing is that there are no people speaking truth to power in the Kremlin, and these people like Patrushev are giving him bad information. And Patrushev is not like Ivanov, who was a seasoned resident, a spy under diplomatic cover, spent a lot of time in Scandinavia and other Western countries, where this guy is, you know, in other words, he's empowered the FSB to do what the SVR does. Is that what you're hearing?
I mean, I think that's a fairly accurate statement, but it's not new. This goes back really to 2012 when Putin came back to the Kremlin and he started to build a network around him of sycophants, of former colleagues in the security services, of people in the military, oligarchs that crossed him either had to leave the country or they were thrown in jail. And therefore, even though you have a lot of people in Russia that are rich, they are rich at the pleasure of the czar. And that means that there really is no effective pushback. Nobody is speaking truth to power. Is it getting worse? Yeah, it may be, given the change that you just discussed and Ivanov's departure. But I don't think that this is anything new. What is new is the mirror imaging that's taking place on this side. You've got Trump, you've got a Pompeo who's heading to the State Department, and John Bolton. All three of them, I think, are worryingly hawkish. It remains to be seen whether that hawkishness gets directed against Russia or not. I think Trump will continue to apply the brakes. But I would say that we are headed into a bumpy and dangerous moment when it comes to national security.
So are we down to one adult in the room, just in closing, the Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, to speak truth to power in the Oval Office?
Well, I would say that Mattis is the most sober of the people that will be around the president. I think the chief of staff, John Kelly, even though tough on issues of immigration and apparently somewhat populist in orientation like the president, is also a seasoned professional. So I don't think that we should all be heading to the border quite yet. And the other point I would make is that even when the president was surrounded by seasoned professionals, including McMaster, Mattis, and Tillerson, he has done an enormous amount of damage. Even when there are adults in the room, we have a president who is his reckless and dangerous. And so I'm not so much worried that the problem is Bolton or the problem is Pompeo, although they may be problems. The core problem is the president of the United States.
Yeah, but another way to interpret what you just told us, Charles Kupchan, is that things have been bad, but they're going to get worse.
I would say that things could take a turn for the worse, and that when it comes to the Iran deal, I certainly wouldn't hold my breath that Trump is going to keep the United States a party to that agreement. I'm hope for the best that when and if the president meets the leader of North Korea, that conversation goes well. But we are certainly, I would say, able to imagine that the United States is going to find itself in another war sometime in 2018.
Well, on that note, sobering as it is, I thank you for joining us, Charles Kupchan.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Kupchan, who was Director of European Affairs on the National Security Council during the Clinton administration. He's now a Professor of International Affairs at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and he spent the last 3 years of the Obama administration as Special Assistant to President Obama for National Security. And his latest book is How Enemies Become Friends, The Sources of Stable Peace. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining moves by China's self-declared leader for life, Xi Jinping, to impose Communist Party censorship on Hollywood movies. But they beg you, pay my name. I got one hell of a job. We're born for the U.S. of A. Got the responsibility of our nation's top security. But every night and day.
Depends on who. I'm gonna get you on a slow boat to China, all to myself alone. Get you and keep you in my arms evermore. Leave all the others waiting on a faraway shore.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ann Kokas, who's a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, whose research examines Sino-U.S. media and technology relations. She is currently a fellow at the Wilson Center, where she's at work on a project titled Border Control on the Digital Frontier, China, the United States, and the Global Battle for Data Security. And her latest book is Hollywood Made in China. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ann Kokas.
Thank you so much, Ann. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you for joining us. And it does seem that China looks upon the Internet and whatever comes into its country digitally via the Internet or in film cans from Hollywood to be shown in, something like 51,000 screens that they have now, 23% over what they had in 2016. So they've got a growing movie industry as well. But they look upon whether it's movies coming in or electronic data coming in to the country, it's the same as crossing its frontier with border guards, etc. Is that the mentality?
Well, what's really interesting in China is there's this idea of comprehensive national power that's held by the Communist Party, which means that things that in the U.S. we don't necessarily consider to be part of our national security are considered part of national security within the Chinese context. So things like films, things like social media platforms, all play into that larger security strategy.
But so far, it seems the focus has been to put up a wall and let in what they deem appropriate and to stop whatever they think is politically dangerous for them. But now it seems that they're reaching outside of that wall and that they want to project their soft power abroad and they're also the Chinese Communist Party's political message. Is that what you're noticing?
So one of the things that I'm seeing in my work is an increased reach of Chinese regulators. Now, this is a combination of factors. One is this kind of global ambition of Chinese regulators to extend China's soft power. But the other factor is that Hollywood studios have an increased interest to really work closely with Chinese regulators in order to get their product into China. So what this means is the Chinese government, rather than having to force Hollywood studios to do specific things, they can say, these are the types of products that we'll let in, and then studios can make a choice to work within those standards or not. Now, the challenge is, this isn't just for the Chinese market. A lot of times these are global products, so this is actually an adjustment of content for the global market rather than just for the Chinese market.
But it does seem that there's a quota, because isn't the Chinese domestic movie industry building? And, of course, China's famous for favoring its own homegrown products. If they take Western imports and make deals with U.S. and other foreign corporations, but then more often than not, they reverse engineer and grab intellectual property. So if they're building a film business, they want it to dominate. And does that automatically mean that because Hollywood will be subject to more and more quotas, or, you know, quotas that allow less and less in, they are therefore more vulnerable to Chinese censorship?
Yes, absolutely. Now, ultimately, what we're seeing is, first of all, the U.S.-China film agreement, which is what established the quota, is currently under negotiation between the U.S. and China. So technically, while China has agreed to continue tentatively with that quota, there's no legally enforceable agreement at this point. So that's already an area of increased vulnerability. What we're also seeing is that as China's market becomes larger and more prominent, there's more incentive for Hollywood studios to really work within the context of the Chinese market. And it's important to note that while we think about Bollywood and we think about the UK and we think about Japan, these as being really substantial global markets, when we add the film market of India, Japan, and the UK together, it still is not the same size as China. So really, it's a very clear destination.
Well, I understand that China's box office receipts last year reached $8.6 billion, and that's compared to the U.S. is $11 billion. It's pretty close, right?
Yeah, and the key difference is also the growth rate. So the U.S. had in the previous year been roughly $11 billion as well, whereas the previous year in 2016, China had been at $6.8 billion.
Mm-hmm. So China's growing, both its domestic film production and audiences. I understand one of the billionaires in China has built a kind of Disneyland out of movie sets. Is that your understanding?
Yes. And there are a wide variety of different efforts to increase the amount of tourist infrastructure that is available in China. I'm guessing that you're talking about Wang Jianlin and his studio installation in Qingdao. But that's a really interesting case because he, as someone who was building this film infrastructure and theme park infrastructure, also really has been criticized by the Chinese government. So we see this also as a vulnerability of the Chinese domestic market, that successful entrepreneurs and successful private companies can be criticized or even taken over by the government, as we saw in the case of Anbang. And what this means is that it's a really delicate market and a really delicate place for Hollywood studios to try to enter and for foreign companies to try to enter more broadly.
And again, I'm speaking with Ann Kokas, who's a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, whose research examines Sino-U.S. media and technology relations. She's currently a fellow at the Wilson Center, where she's at work on a project titled Border Control on the Digital Frontier, China, the United States, and the Global Battle for Data Security. And her latest book is Hollywood Made in China. So my understanding is that Chinese censors have standards which they impose, like China's national dignity, honor, and interest cannot be harmed or damaged, and another infraction would be harming social stability or hurting national feelings. Is that the way that they characterize their level of censorship, at least some of their censorship?
Well, so there are a lot of different ways in which censorship happens. One thing that's important to note within the Chinese context is that all films have to be available to general audiences. So whereas in the U.S. we have a rating system in which there can be films with more or less violence and sex and different types of controversial content in R-rated movies versus G-rated movies. In China, everything has to be available to general audiences. So that is a major portion of the lion's share of the censorship that happens. So that's an important thing to note. Now, there are definitely challenges for any kind of political content that negatively represents the Chinese government. Now, China's not the only country that does that, and that's important to note. But it is something that creates a challenge when we're looking at global markets, particularly global markets with commercial film companies that are based in the United States that are trying to work with and make films that are distributed in China. This does have a chilling effect on the types of content that might be created for these large global blockbusters with Chinese aspirations.
Well, the Russians, of course, just banned a film called The Death of Stalin. And I believe the Chinese banned one of the movies that was up for the Academy Awards, which has a sort of homosexual theme. I think it's Call Me By Your Name or Tell Me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They can't handle that right.
But I think one thing that's important to note is that the quota films, because it's such a small number, tend not to be smaller dramas. So even with the content of Call Me By Your Name, the films that studios tend to send to the Chinese market don't tend to differ from that particular type of genre.
Right.
So, for example, we see a lot more superhero movies or these kind of really big spectacles, animated films, and some of that is related to the content of the films themselves and concerns about censorship. But a large portion of that is also related to just the desire to send the most expensive films to the Chinese market in order to get the biggest potential return from that box office. So if you only have a certain number of films to send to China, financially it makes sense to send the ones that you need to get the biggest global return from.
Well, that seems to be a train that's already left the station because clearly they're making films for 15-year-old boys or in China and other countries where the language is not important. It's all about special effects and explosions and action and superheroes. And that's already happened. But what apparently is concerning is that some of the movies already, first of all, this movie that's out now, Pacific Rim, seems to be a perfectly tailor-made for that kind of international market and particularly the Chinese market. God knows why kids like all that weird stuff, but that just makes me sound like I'm old, I guess. But already I understand that Transformers number 4, they tailor to a Chinese censors. They slipped in some praise of the Chinese Communist Party. They rewrote the remake of Red Dawn to make the armies invading the U.S. not Chinese but North Korean. And then in Doctor Strange, they recast the mystic from being a Tibetan to being Celtic. So no mention of Tibet, which of course is a red flag to China. So already it does seem that Hollywood is kowtowing to Chinese censorship.
So now some of the things that I think are particularly interesting when we're seeing these discussions are also the ways in which it's not just about content censorship, but about the perceived demands or interests of the Chinese box office. And one really good example of this is the case of Black Panther. So there was concern about Black Panther's potential global impact because the characters on Black Panther are African-American and African. And one of the arguments that was used by some studios about, you know, the potential risk for Black Panther's global box office is resistance to black characters in global films. And I think what we see there is really this kind of dark merging of the racial challenges that we see in Hollywood with perceptions of censorship and the limitations of Chinese audiences. And in a case like that, those are kind of discussions and limitations that emerge not merely from Chinese regulators, but from conservative responses on the part of Hollywood studios about what Chinese regulators and Chinese audiences might think. So from my perspective, there's this intersection of the market and the regulatory structure in China that in some ways can be pulling down the type of content and making studios make even more conservative choices than they might otherwise make.
Well, I noticed that on Chinese television, on their main state TV show, they had a kind of some variety show, I can't remember what it was now, where they did parodies of black characters, somewhat similar to what, you know, early films, you know, in the 1930s, the only black actors were all caricatures, like in Gone with the Wind, for example. But these parodies that they were on the main Chinese channel were absolutely amazingly racist, the way they dressed up their Chinese actors as Africans and exaggerated their physical features. So is that an issue here? I mean, how did Black Panther do, by the way, in China?
So it's really interesting. Black Panther's box office in China was quite good. However, there was a lot of resistance online, and there was a lot of critique on Chinese digital and social platforms about Black Panther. Now, what's really interesting in the Chinese film market is that a film doesn't necessarily have to be well-reviewed to do really well in the box office. And so Black Panther was a great case of that, where there wasn't actually a lot of kind of popular sentiment online, but there were really big box office numbers. Now, one of the challenges that I think we see here is, you know, if there are, you know, racial issues or, you know, discrimination in other countries, in addition to those in our own, it doesn't make sense to magnify those by limiting the types of characters or the types of content that we're distributing for the global market. So trends like that actually really I find very concerning, because those aren't even deliberately dictated by Chinese regulators. Those are just as a result of market forces.
And just turning in the last few minutes here, Ann Kokas, to the study you're doing at the Wilson Center, Border Control on the Digital Frontier, China, the United States, and the Global Battle for Data Security. I'm hearing from a lot of Chinese specialists that, first of all, we know that the biggest gift to China right out of the bat from Donald Trump was getting rid of the TPP. Yeah. And a lot of people saying that the TPP, if the TPP were in force, China would be behaving differently, and maybe Xi Jinping wouldn't have declared himself a ruler for life. What's your take on that when you're talking about having a global battle over data security? China doesn't have to play by the rules anymore. That was the whole idea of TPP, from what I understand. And now China's able to write its own rules.
Yeah, well, this is a huge area of concern. Now, when the United States is actively participating in multilateral agreements and multi-stakeholder organizations, agreements like the TPP or multi-stakeholder organizations, like the Internet Governance Forum or the ITU, and sending representatives and sending people to participate in those multi-stakeholder organizations, then we're actually able to have a seat at the table and to have influence. However, what we're seeing right now, particularly in the Internet governance space, is that not only is the U.S., not only is China kind of taking, not always following the rules, but they're also following the rules and shaping a lot of the organizations that the United States was involved in founding with regard to the Internet governance space. And we're actually pulling out, or if the U.S. government is pulling out and hoping that U.S. corporations will take a stand and assert themselves within those organizations. Now, the challenge is U.S. corporations like Hollywood Studios, Apple, Facebook, Netflix,
right.
They're all trying to enter the Chinese market, so they're not actually going to be pushing back against what China has to say in those organizations.
Well, we've certainly seen what Facebook is capable of not doing, shall we say.
Right, exactly.
So that does not bode well. But,
no.
But in general, is there a political dimension to this, the fact that we know that Donald Trump has been an enormous gift to Vladimir Putin? For some reason or other, he can't criticize him, and even though he's just kicked out a bunch of Russian spies. But it does seem that the getting rid of the TPP was a major gift to China, and it did seem that Trump was totally flattered by them when he visited. So what's your sense of U.S. being absent here as the champion of democracy? In the phone call to Putin, he was told by his national security advisors not to congratulate Putin for winning a rigged election, and he went ahead and did it at any rate. So do you think that our leader, who is not a champion of democracy, is affecting China to the extent that it's given Xi Jinping a free hand?
Absolutely. I mean, when I saw that President Xi had, now has the option to be leader for life, and our president congratulated him rather than expressing, as many of us in the field of China studies, as well as in different countries around the world, concern about the absence of term limits within the Chinese context, which should help to normalize Chinese politics after the fall of Mao. This is deeply concerning, and it really shifts the type of discourse that the U.S. is having with China. We had been moving toward more engagement. We had been moving toward a normalization of relations. We had been moving toward a more normalized Chinese political system in which there was a succession of leaders. And at this point, we're entering an era in which strongmen are emerging within the context of China and Russia, and our president, rather than trying to offer an alternative, is praising these developments.
Well, Ann Kokas, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me on.
Likewise, I enjoyed the conversation. And again, I've been speaking with Ann Kokas, who's a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia, whose research examines Sino-U.S. media and technology relations. She's currently a fellow at the Wilson Center, where she's at work on a project titled Border Control on the Digital Frontier, China, the United States, and the Global Battle for Data Security. And her latest book is Hollywood Made in China. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the op-ed by former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens, Repeal the Second Amendment.
Shined his boots and combed his dark hair down, and his mother cried as he walked out, "Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town." He laughed and kissed his mom and said, "Your Billy Joe's a man. I can."
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jonathan Lowy, who's the director of the Legal Action Project at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He leads a team of attorneys in providing pro bono legal representation to victims of gun violence. For over two decades, Mr. Lowy has litigated lawsuits against gun manufacturers, dealers, and owners where guns have not been made, sold, or stored responsibly, as well as attacks on gun laws on Second Amendment grounds. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Lowy.
My pleasure to be here.
So, Jonathan, what did you make of the op-ed in today's New York Times by the former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens titled Repeal the Second Amendment?
Well, I have tremendous respect for Justice Stevens. He is a great legal mind and was a great Supreme Court justice. I disagree with his basic point, which is that whatever one thinks of the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Second Amendment, even under the Supreme Court's recent rulings and Justice Scalia's opinion in the Heller decision, virtually all, if not all, common sense gun violence prevention measures should be held constitutional. And so that's where I disagree with the justice. We should still be able to get universal background checks, assault weapon ban, and other reasonable measures, at least under the current Supreme Court precedent.
So in other words, even though the Heller decision, as you mentioned, brought forward by Justice Scalia, who was a gun enthusiast himself, where it put the the cart before the horse, or reversed the predicate, which was a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the second part being the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That's become the new focus under Heller. But you're saying that even under Heller, the things that all of these high school students were asking for here in the extraordinary demonstrations that took place over the weekend in Washington, D.C., prohibiting semi-automatic weapons, increasing the minimum age to buy guns, and establishing a more comprehensive background check, all of those can be done under Heller. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Justice Scalia wrote the majority opinion in Heller, included a section in Part 3 of the opinion that goes out of its way to say that virtually all, it doesn't use these words, but the import is that virtually all common sense gun violence prevention measures remain constitutional. And there's a framework there to uphold the agenda of the Brady Center and Brady campaign and of the Parkland students. I mean, the ban on assault weapons is a great example. There have been a number of legal challenges brought against state assault weapon bans, and in every single one of them, the courts across the country have held that those bans are constitutional, and there is not Second Amendment protection for military-style assault weapons. And I think universal background checks would be constitutional even more clearly.
So when Justice John Paul Stevens says in his op-ed, Repeal the Second Amendment, that the Heller decision, which I remain convinced was wrong and certainly was debatable, has provided the NRA with a propaganda weapon of immense power. Would you not agree with that?
I agree and I disagree. I mean, the fact is the NRA would use the Second Amendment as a propaganda piece and mislead the American people and misuse it regardless of what the interpretation is. I mean, if the Heller decision went the other way, the NRA would certainly use that as a huge rallying cry and propaganda piece. If it was repealed, they would use it as well. So I don't think that the problem of the NRA goes away if you change the Second Amendment. I mean, the one caveat I would give to all this is I'm assuming that courts will continue to interpret the Second Amendment as they have in the 10 years since the Heller decision. It's possible that if Donald Trump remakes the Supreme Court, that that could change. And if you had a Supreme Court that began interpreting it in the extremist way that the NRA would like, then that would be a serious problem. But we don't have that yet.
But the amazing thing about the NRA is that when these massacres, these mass shootings take place, like Columbine, Sandy Hook, and now the Parkland, Florida High School, they lay low, don't say anything. Now they're saying some snarky things about the students and about billionaires backing them and Hollywood celebrities and this kind of nonsense, when that was clearly an amazing display of high school kids putting on their own rally, which they themselves controlled. And it was, I thought that was what was so powerful about it, that it was authentic. But nevertheless, what the NRA does is they lay low, and then they come back with even more aggressive pro-gun, anti-regulation rules. And the latest one, of course, is that they want to be able to have concealed carry permits be able to cross state lines, which is would end any semblance of gun control in this country.
Well, I think you're right about the NRA's modus operandi. If you're ever puzzled about what the NRA is doing or what they're going to do, just think what will sell the most guns. Because in every case, their solution is the one that would sell the most guns and drive the most profit to the gun industry that bankrolls them. And that's what you see behind the move to arm teachers. Those are gun sales. To, you know, relaxing carry laws. not banning military-style assault weapons. All of these things are just maximizing gun sales, and it exposes the fact that the NRA no longer is speaking for gun owners. It's just speaking for gun companies.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Lowy, who's the director of the Legal Action Project at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He leads a team of attorneys in providing pro bono legal representation to victims of gun violence. And for over two decades, Mr. Lowy has litigated lawsuits against gun manufacturers, dealers and owners where guns have not been made, sold or stored responsibly, as well as attacks on gun laws on Second Amendment grounds. Well, we know that President Trump is completely controlled by the NRA. He makes wonderful gestures on camera to a group, bipartisan group of lawmakers, and then the NRA visits him and he reverses himself on all of his promises. So if you say that if he gets any more choices on the Supreme Court, they may not bode well for gun safety, I'd say that's a pretty safe bet, wouldn't you?
Well, you know, we can pray for the health and longevity of Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her colleagues. You know, so we'll have to see. We'll have to see what happens. Certainly, all of the indications from Justice Gorsuch are not good. I mean, he joined Justice Thomas in an extremely radical opinion regarding Second Amendment that fortunately the other justices did not join, but that's certainly troubling, and it would be troubling if he has other selections to make to the Supreme Court.
What exactly was that? Because I must have missed that one. What was the case?
Well, it was a not particularly notable because it was what's called a dissental, not a dissent, but a dissental, which is where the Supreme Court refuses to take a case, and in this case it was, and I may be mistaken on this, I believe it was a lower court opinion that upheld the assault weapon ban, but I may be incorrect about that, and the Supreme Court declined to review that and let the law stand, or the appellate decision stand, and Justice Thomas and Gorsuch issued an opinion saying they disagreed. They thought that the Supreme Court should have taken the case, and in doing so, they expressed a rather radical view of the Second Amendment. And if that sort of view were to garner a majority, five justices, that would be extremely dangerous for our gun laws. But again, as it stands now, even with a conservative-leaning Supreme Court, there were not any other justices who would agree with Thomas Gorsuch.
Well, again, it seems that you have these repeated massacres, lots of public outrage. The only thing that's changed has been the emergence of these young students as a political force, which certainly has made a lot of people feel much more hopeful about our future. But as I say, the NRA is laying low and they're going to come back strong, and they've got these allies on the Supreme Court. So short of what the former Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens is recommending, which is to repeal the Second Amendment, that's obviously a long process. A constitutional amendment is pretty onerous. What would you recommend is the best measure to fight back? Because clearly the pro-gun people have been winning for the last few decades.
Well, I am very optimistic. And actually, you were reading off an old bio of mine. I've actually been working full-time in gun violence prevention at the Brady Center for 20 years. And I don't think I've ever been as optimistic as I am at this moment. And certainly the Parkland students are just extraordinarily inspiring, and I think they've inspired the country. But even before that, we've seen a lot of positive signs that from exit polls and in the Virginia governor's election and a few others that have shown that there's just more intense support on the side of gun violence prevention than on the other side. And in some cases more than ever. And that's been building for some time, and it certainly seems to be crystallizing now. And I think it's going to continue, because what you're seeing is these young people are making gun violence prevention a priority issue. And that's really what it's all about. The fact is there's long been overwhelming majorities of Americans who support universal background checks and other common sense measures. The problem has been it's been viewed that there hasn't been enough intensity of support on that side of the issue, and we're seeing that change. So I think people just need to remain active. They need to go to the polls. They need to view gun violence prevention as a number one issue, an issue that if you've got a candidate who may be good on other issues, but if they're not supporting universal background checks, if they're not supporting an assault weapon ban, don't vote for them. And if that happens and Americans get the Congress that actually represents their views on safety and gun issues, that will change, and we will have, you know, sensible laws, and the courts will uphold those laws. So we just have to stay involved and make sure that there is no issue more important than the safety of our families and safety from gun violence.
Well, just in the last minute, though, does that mean that the opposition has to get as tough and even as thuggish as the NRA? They'll primary you if you don't vote their way, and obviously they buy these congressmen. So does that mean that we have to spend more upping the ante, buying them with more money and intimidating them more?
I would not say thuggish, and I wouldn't say money. I just think people need to vote what they actually believe. I mean, over 90% of Americans support background checks for all gun sales.
Mm-hmm.
If people just took that issue seriously, then we would have the Congress that we deserve. And, I mean, just think about how extreme someone would have to be to oppose universal background checks. That means that you believe that a convicted felon or domestic violence abuser
or a terrorist
should be able to go to a gun show or go online and buy guns without a background check, no questions asked.
Right.
That's an outrageous position which virtually no Americans agree with, and yet a majority of the U.S. Senate agrees with it. And so people, they don't need to be thuggish. They just need to be principled and firm and take this issue seriously.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Jonathan Lowy.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Lowy, who's the director of the Legal Action Project at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He leads a team of attorneys in providing pro bono legal representation to victims of gun violence. And for over two decades, Mr. Lowy has litigated lawsuits against gun manufacturers, dealers, and owners where guns have not been made, sold, or stored responsibly, as well as attacks on gun laws on Second Amendment grounds. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.